Well, let's see whether we can wrap up this unit and adjourn for the weekend. I've already mentioned a little bit about 19, right? And the point of 19 is that the final adjustment to the concentration of urine is done where urine is born, in a sense, the collecting duct. I say it's born there because that's when we finally call it urine. But when it first gets dumped into the collecting duct by the distal convoluted tubules of the nephrons that are connected to that particular collecting duct, it's fairly dilute urine. And if needed, it can be concentrated. That's the final adjustment to the urine. It adjusts concentration not by adjusting solutes, but by adjusting water. If needed, water will be reabsorbed. And how does the water get reabsorbed? If it needs to be? Through aquaporins, exactly. Now, this is where we left off. The aquaporins are already pre-built, and they exist in these vesicles, which are fully inside the cells that make up the tubule wall, collecting duct wall. But if they need to be, they can be embedded into the plasma membrane where they actually function as aquaporins. So that's how the adjustment is made. But when you put an aquaporin into the plasma membrane of a cell, an aquaporin is a channel. It's just a specific channel for water. And therefore, when you have an open channel in a membrane, what determines movement through it? Gradient, right. So water is only going to be reabsorbed if it's going down its gradient from the collecting duct lumen to the interstitium. That's what the blue arrows indicate. Well, water gets lost from the collecting duct because, like I said, that urine at the top part of the collecting duct up at the cortex is pretty dilute. Therefore, the interstitial fluid that surrounds the collecting duct is less watery than the urine in the collecting duct. And when you open up these channels, water will osmose down its gradient, which means it's going to leave the tubule. Now, the solutes are remaining back in the urine, so when you lose the water, that makes the concentration go up. But water is only going to continue to osmose for as long as there is a gradient in place, right? If enough water moves that you have the same wateriness in the collecting duct as you do in the interstitial fluid, there would be no more tendency for water to move in either direction. So what causes water to continue to be lost from the collecting duct in the case of ADH secretion, antidiuretic hormone, is the fact that the medulla is not only more concentrated, the interstitium of the medulla, the medullary interstitium, it's not only more concentrated with solutes than the cortex is, but the deeper you go into the medulla, meaning toward the bottom of the nephron loops, the more concentrated those solutes get in the medullary interstitium. And therefore, well, when you say that the interstitium has a higher concentration of solutes, that means it's less watery. So even though water has already been removed from urine at the top here, by the time it reaches deeper into the medulla, it's still more watery. The tubular fluid is still more watery than the interstitium because it continues to be continues to be juxtaposed next to something that's even saltier than itself and less watery. If you had nothing but 300 milliosmol all the way down this thickness in the interstitium, then only water would leave only until the collecting duct contents, which is the urine, would be 300 milliosmol, and it would not be able to be concentrated. Okay, so that's the key to being able to concentrate urine The key is that the medullary interstitium is a gradient of solute concentration with an increasing concentration the deeper you go in the medulla. Now, what is responsible for that gradient? What establishes that medullary interstitial gradient? Anyone know? Well, that's why I'm here. Let's go to 20 and see what the answer is. The answer is the collection of nephron loops of the juxtamedullary nephrons, the ones that are longer, right? The juxtamedullary ones are the ones that have the long nephron loops, and it's those long nephron loops that make up the tubular part of the medulla itself. Okay? It's important that the nephron loops are loops, meaning that they go in one direction and then turn around and go back in the other direction. It's important that they have countercurrent flow, flow of tubular contents downward in the descending loop, which comes first in terms of the flow of contents, and then upward toward the, back toward the cortex in the ascending limb. Okay? Now, this wouldn't make any sense if the two limbs were equally permeable to the same things, right? Because any change that occurred on the way down would just be undone on the way up. And that's why they're not equally permeable to the same things. The descending limb, as I said earlier, is mostly thin segment. As you see here, most of this is thin segment. And the blue arrows here show you that water is coming out. So the descending limb of the nephron loop is permeable to water, but pretty impermeable to solutes. All right? On the other hand, most, if not all, depending on the nephron, of the ascending loop, or ascending limb of the loop, is thick-walled, or the thick segment, as we call it, and it is impermeable to water, so water doesn't go in or out in most of the, for most of the ascending limb, and the reason that that thick segment is thick is because those cells that make up the thick wall are busy acting as pumps. So it's impermeable to water, but it's a place all along the ascending limb where a lot of solutes get pumped out. Sodium, potassium, and chloride being chief among them. Okay? What we have here is a positive feedback loop, really. This is what establishes to begin with and then maintains throughout your life that gradient of salinity as you descend through the medullary interstitium from cortex downward. The salt is brought in as a content of the tubular fluid. So the proximal convoluted tubule is delivering salt continuously that has been filtered out at the glomerulus. It's delivering that salt as part of the tubular fluid to the descending limb. All right, but as it's going down that descending limb, that salt doesn't leave because I said the descending limb is impermeable to solutes. It loses water, though, along the way because it is freely permeable to water. And the reason it the tubule loses water, the loop itself, is because of this gradient in the interstitium, just like for the collecting duct. But this is not the collecting duct yet. This is the nephron loop. So this doesn't, this water is leaving because the gradient has already been established. But what establishes it to begin with is what's happening on the ascending limb. The ascending limb, which is receiving that salt from the what was originally filtered and that hasn't escaped on the descending part, is now being pumped out from the ascending part. All right? Well, the more you pump out, the more concentrated in solutes, the interstitial fluid gets, which is where these things, where these solutes are being pumped to. They're being pumped out of the tubule, through the wall of the tubule, into the interstitial fluid, the medullary interstitium. And so there's a lot being pumped out right here where it first makes the turn upward, because none of that salt has been removed yet on its way down. So there's a lot being pumped there. The more you remove, the less there is left. But on its way up, that continues being pumped out. So the interstitium isn't as concentrated the farther you go back up. And that's what gives rise to the gradient. And since this is always happening, the gradient, once it's established, is kept there. It's like that for your whole life, as long as you're operating normally. And so then, and that's why it makes sense that once you have that in place, the next batch of fluid that's coming down is going to lose water because that gradient is already there. And therefore, every time a little piece of fluid or a little slug of fluid moves downward, it still is more watery than the interstitium, because now that interstitium is even more salty than it was above. Does that make sense? So what all this means is that the tubular fluid, the urine to be, on its way down the loop, becomes more and more concentrated, less and less watery. But then on its way back up, it becomes more and more watery again. So the nephron loop is not about concentrating the urine. The nephron loop is about establishing this medullary interstitial gradient of salinity, which is what's required then, finally, for the collecting duct to be able to take advantage of that gradient in order, if necessary, to make the final adjustment to the concentration of the urine. Does that all make sense? Okay. In 21, we can see a nephron loop, a collecting duct beside it, and also vasa recta. Remember that vasa recta refers to the second alternative, second capillary bed in series in this renal portal system. So you, instead of having, what's the other alternative? What is it? Paratubular what? Right, paratubular capillary, which is a capillary bed around the proximal convoluted tubule. You also have vasa recta, which is a capillary bed around the loops of Henle, or the nephron loops. And the main point of this slide is that I've already talked about sodium and chloride and potassium, their role in this gradient of salinity. Well, urea is actually also a big player. Urea contributes to that osmotic gradient or gradient of salinity. Now, urea, we already know, comes from what? What is urea? It's what? Anyone else want to say something? What is urea? Figure you got all weekend, I guess, for the test? You know what? Someone in here knows what urea is. That was day one of this chapter. It is waste. What kind of waste? Nitrogenous waste, so nitrogen-containing waste, that comes from what mainly? Right, it does. It's urea is manufactured by stringing together two ammonias, basically. Where does the ammonia come from? Catabolism of what? Proteins, right. So urea is waste, nitrogenous waste, that's you don't want to let get too high a level in the blood. And therefore, that's a major job of the kidney, is to get rid of it. Well, the kidney does get rid of urea continuously. In other words, some of it does make it into the final urine. But urea also gets looped around in a cycle so that there's always some of it in the medullary interstitium contributing to this gradient. And so you can see by the arrows here that urea exits the collecting duct. Now, not all of it, of course, because some of it's going to be left behind and be part of the urine. But there's always some urea that's coming out of the collecting duct and then entering the descending limb for a trip back around, and then it's going to exit again, and it just keeps going around and around. So that keeps a certain amount of urea in this medullary interstitium, and that the more urea you have in there, just like the more ionic solutes you have, the less watery that tissue is, interstitial fluid is, and therefore the stronger the gradient for water to come out of the collecting duct, assuming that ADH is present and you have the aquaporins in those cell membranes. Now, the vasa recta is important that it has countercurrent as well, because that's a way for this gradient not to be dissipated by the blood. On the trip down, notice that the blood gets very highly concentrated because it loses water to the interstitial fluid. Now, that would normally dilute the interstitial fluid. I mean, it does dilute it, actually, but then it undoes itself on the way up. And so water comes in and the blood becomes normalized as far as osmolarity is concerned. Actually, there's even more water taken up on the way up than there is lost on the way down. So it actually adds to the gradient a little bit as well. All right. 22. Here we're looking at the various hormones that affect the kidneys. We've talked about a lot of this already, but I guess it's worth kind of reading this to you. Aldosterone, what is that classified as? Did you say hormone? Yeah, well, all these are hormones. But what category of hormones is aldosterone? It is a steroid. What kind of steroid? It's a mineralocorticoid. Why is it called a corticoid? Because it comes from the cortex of what? Right. It's an adrenal cortical hormone released from the adrenal cortex. And it's released in response to blood pressure changes, right? When blood pressure gets high or low, notice that it promotes sodium reabsorption. Would you expect that to be operating when blood pressure is high or low? Low, right. Why is that? Based on sodium. If sodium gets reabsorbed more in response to aldosterone, what happens? Water is going to follow osmotically. So the more sodium gets saved for the blood and not put into the urine, which is what aldosterone causes, the more watery the blood gets, and therefore the more volume of blood there is, and therefore the greater the pressure it's exerting. So in response to low pressure, the sodium is saved, the water gets reabsorbed, and the blood pressure goes back up because the blood volume goes back up. And remember that aldosterone is also part of this angiotensin system that we talked about. Renin, what is renin? It is an enzyme released by what? By the kidneys, right. That's why it's called renin. What does that enzyme do? Right, angiotensinogen, which is released where? By the liver, is too big a polypeptide to operate as a hormone. It needs to be clipped. It gets clipped in two stages, right? Renin is the first stage of clipping. So the renal enzyme called renin clips the hepatic pre-pro hormone, which is called angiotensinogen, and that forms it into angiotensin 1. What is the final clipping? What does that? Something from the lungs, and what is it called? ACE, which is acronymous for what? Right, angiotensin converting enzyme. That's excellent reading. So it takes a couple more amino acids off of it, and now it's in its final form, angiotensin II. We talked about that, but this is a similar situation, right? This reduces water loss, so this would be in response to low blood pressure. You want to save the water when the blood pressure is low. Antidiuretic hormone, notice it affects the collecting duct, just like we've been saying. Antidiuretic hormone comes from where? No. Posterior pituitary, otherwise known as what? The neurohypophysis, exactly. The neurohypophysis releases two hormones. Does anyone know the other one, by the way? Oxytocin, right. And so what kind of hormones are those, since it's part of the neurohypophysis? Neurohormones, right. They're released directly from axon terminals. Well, the axon terminals, the ends of those neurons that make up the posterior pituitary or neurohypophysis, release this ADH when you need to save the water for the blood and not waste it in the urine. And that's when, in response to that ADH, the collecting duct cells, by receiving that signal, will take those vesicles with the aquaporins in them and embed those vesicles into the membrane, so the aquaporins are now channels into the cell. That's what allows the water then to leave the tubule. But the only reason it leaves the tubule is because as the urine flows down deeper into the medulla, the surroundings become more and more salty, less and less watery, and so water continues to come out all the way down. And so you can make it a lot more concentrated than it starts out as when the distal convoluted tubule first dumps it into the collecting duct. We didn't talk much about, if at all, about natriuretic peptide. What does natri mean? Uretic means in the urine, right? Sodium, right. The reason sodium has the symbol Na is because another name for it is natrium. And similarly, kalium is another name for potassium, which is why it's K. So natriuretic means putting sodium into the urine. Okay? So notice that what it does is dilate the afferent arteriole, constrict the efferent arteriole. That means you're going to pressurize the glomerulus, right? Because you're shutting down the exit, you're opening up the entrance. That's going to increase glomerular filtration rate because of that bigger pressure. It also inhibits the secretion of renin. Renin is the enzyme we just talked about that is appropriate when blood pressure is low, right? You don't want that to be occurring now. It inhibits ADH and aldosterone, all of which work in the same way, basically. And this has the effect of, it also inhibits sodium chloride reabsorption. Well, when you inhibit sodium chloride reabsorption, you also inhibit reabsorption of the water that follows it. So you're basically preventing the blood volume from going up anymore in response to what is already a higher blood pressure than you should have. Well, what is it that releases natriuretic peptide? I mentioned this, I think, back in the endocrine chapter. Maybe I didn't. It's released by the heart. So this is why the heart also qualifies as an endocrine organ. The reason it's appropriate for the heart to do this is because the heart is busy pumping the blood. When the blood pressure is too high, the heart feels it by being stretched. And in response to that, it releases natriuretic peptide, which has its effect on the kidney. Calcitonin and calcitriol we already talked about, right? Those both have to do with calcium. Calcitriol is otherwise known as what? Active vitamin D, yes. So that calcitriol is the one that needs to be doubly hydroxylated, triply hydroxylated originally. Eventually, but that's the one that involves the skin and then the liver, then finally the kidney, and then it operates on the small intestines primarily. Epinephrine and norepinephrine. Now, epinephrine can be norepinephrine can be either a hormone or a neurotransmitter, depending on how it's being used. Here we're talking about it as a hormone. Where are epinephrine and norepinephrine released from? Adrenal glands, right. And which part? The medulla, right. So these are not corticosteroids, these are adrenomedullary hormones. And they notice that they operate on the juxtaglomerular apparatus. What is that? The juxtaglomerular apparatus is that collection of parts that we talked about where the ascending loop comes back up and kind of kisses the glomerulus, where I was talking about autoregulation. So that's where they operate. And notice that it induces renin secretion, constricts the afferent arteriole, reduces GFR, and therefore reduces urine volume. Now, why would that be appropriate in response to epinephrine? When is epinephrine released by the adrenal medulla? Stress or exercise, right? So if you're exercising, you're going to require a greater heart rate, greater blood or stroke volume. You need to pump a lot of blood to the exercising skeletal muscles. Well, that would mean that would tend to increase your glomerular filtration rate, like I was saying, right? So the response is not to let it get too high in the kidneys. So the glomeruli operate as normal rather than increased. And then parathyroid hormone, obviously released by the parathyroid hormones, where are they? On the thyroid gland for most people. They can actually be off of it as well. But there's usually four of them on the posterior surface of the thyroid gland. And they are very important for calcium ion concentration, right, in the blood. So the reason that the kidney is involved is because parathyroid hormone promotes calcium reabsorption, saving it for the blood, in other words. What does it do to the bone? What does parathyroid hormone do to the bone at the same time it's acting on the kidney? It's telling the kidney not to waste any calcium. So obviously it's released in response to low calcium ion concentration, right, in the blood. So while it's telling the kidney not to get rid of any of the calcium, because we need more, what's it telling the bones at the same time? Break down your store of calcium in the hydroxyapatite. There's a lot of calcium stored in that, and release that calcium to the blood. Yeah. 23 is basically a summary slide of urine formation. So the filtration, which isn't really indicated here, is of course happening at the renal corpuscle. Filtration occurs through the glomerular filter. Then, what are the other two components besides filtration? Reabsorption, secretion, which happen in opposite directions. Reabsorption, notice all the arrows for the purple boxes, which are reabsorption. They're all pointing out of the tubule. Reabsorption takes things out of the tubular fluid and puts them back into the blood. And notice that the list of things in the purple box at the proximal convoluted tubule is a lot longer than the list of things at the distal convoluted tubule. Like I said, most of the filtrate, which comes from the corpuscle and enters the tubule, gets reabsorbed right away at the proximal convoluted tubule. So most of the good things that you want back in the blood come back into the blood via reabsorption at the PCT. But there is reabsorption at the distal convoluted tubule as well, and there's also reabsorption of certain things at the loop, like we talked about, and at the collecting duct, water primarily, but also urea in that cycle. The pink boxes are for secretion, which is to take things out of the blood that haven't been filtered, but that need to be removed, actively pumping them into the tubular fluid so that they eventually become part of the urine. And one thing I said before, but I want to repeat, is that what happens at the proximal convoluted tubule isn't nearly as controlled moment to moment. It basically happens more or less the same all the time. What the secretion and absorption that occurs at the distal convoluted tubule and also the collecting duct, those are what are really controlled to make the final version of the urine what it is. And even though there's reabsorption and secretion at the loop, that's really not about making the urine what it is. It's more about making this medullary interstitial gradient of salinity. 24. Well, now we're back to some pure anatomy. In this frontal view of the urinary bladder, we can see the interior of the urinary bladder. And the triangle that you see here is called the trigone. The vertices of that triangle are just openings. So that triangle, you really have to mentally draw it. It doesn't really look like a triangle, but there are three openings that form a nice triangle. And those three openings, or the two openings where the ureters empty into the urinary bladder. So those are the ureteral openings. And then there's also an opening that leads to the urethra. So two of those three openings are entrances into the urinary bladder. One is an exit from the urinary bladder. Notice also that the urethra is guarded by or controlled by two different sphincters, an internal urethral sphincter and an external urethral sphincter. Internal and external here mean really deeper and more superficial with respect to the surface of the body. The internal urethral sphincter, notice, occurs right at the very beginning of the urethra as it comes out of the urinary bladder. The external urethral sphincter is positioned at what is called the urogenital diaphragm, which is a thick membranous layer before it exits the body. And the reason there's A and B here is because males and females differ with respect to the length of their urethra, mainly because of the presence of a penis in most males. So there's still the same situation with respect to the sphincters in a male. One difference, though, is that the urethra of a male is broken down into sections, serially placed, one after another. So we talk about what's called the prostatic urethra, because that very first part of the urethra is totally surrounded by the prostate gland. And we see it cut here, that's why we can see the lumen of the prostatic urethra, but it would normally be entirely encircled by the prostate. And that's why, as men age and their prostate enlarges, you get urinary difficulties. Or actually difficulties with micturition, I should say, not actually production of urine. The second section of urethra in a male is this very short section that just goes through this urogenital diaphragm that I was talking about. And that's called the membranous urethra simply because that urogenital diaphragm is a membrane. So that's the shortest by far. And then there is the most variable part in length, depending on the length of the penis. And that is the spongy urethra, simply because the penis, as we'll talk about more later, is made up of three columns of tissue, one of which is spongy in appearance. The one that it actually goes through is one that's spongy in appearance. It's called the corpus spongiosum. So then you're officially outside of the body. Well, it's strictly speaking, you're already outside the body, right? This is another one of these openings, but that's the end of the line as far as getting it, getting the urine completely out of you. Now there are, let me leave it at that. Let's go to 25. 25 has to do with micturition. Is that spelled there? Yeah, right here. Micturition. Micturition is the term for the intermittent voiding of the urinary bladder. So what you probably call urination is micturition. Like I said earlier, we more or less continuously are producing urine. Our kidneys are always working. So it's trickling in through the two ureters into the urinary bladder until the bladder gets full enough to cause the person to notice that. So the urinary bladder itself Actually, let me temporarily go back to 24 to show you the urinary bladder. Urinary bladder itself is made up of what kind of epithelium? Well, there is no elastic epithelium. It is elastic, but it's not a called elastic epithelium. Anyone remember from 201? It's called transitional epithelium. The ureters are as well, but especially the urinary bladder. And what makes transitional epithelium transitional, meaning able to undergo a change, is that the cells that make it up are first when the bladder is empty. Those cells are stacked, so the epithelium is highly stratified. And the cells are kind of columnar. When the more urine that enters through the ureters into the urinary bladder, the bigger the bladder gets, of course, and so that stretches the walls. If it were an ordinary epithelium, that would tear the epithelium. And so since it's made of transitional epithelium, what happens is that it goes from being more stratified to less stratified. So the cells slide past each other, basically, and there are fewer stacked together. And also the individual cells go from more columnar to more squamous as they are stretched. So this prevents what would be tears and therefore holes in the epithelium. The transition makes sure that there's always continuous epithelial cells lining the surface. But in addition to that, there are folds, just like in the stomach, folds in it called rugae. And as the bladder fills, these folds unfold, and that also allows it to expand. So the bladder can hold an impressive amount, actually, the urinary bladder. But, back to 25... there is a limit that you're able to tolerate, most people. Well, here's where the two sphincters come into play. The internal sphincter is not so controllable by you. It keeps urine in the urinary bladder. But in response to being stretched, you have the involuntary micturition reflex. So we see here. So there's enough urine that's collected that it's stretching it to the point that stretch receptors in the wall of the urinary bladder get activated. That causes these stretch receptors are neurons, or connected to neurons, and so they cause these neurons to fire to create action potentials. That's what the green arrow is. And that travels to the spinal cord, lower part of the spinal cord, the S2 region. And notice that information travels upward to the pons and cerebrum. So not only is the spinal cord hearing about this as part of a reflex behind the scenes, but also a branch from this neuron is sending this information up to your brain so that you're consciously aware of the fullness as well. Well, the reflex, though, occurs right here, only involving the spinal cord, like we've talked about reflexes before. And so that sends efferent information, of course the green is afferent information, sends efferent or motor information via the parasympathetic system to the detrusor muscles that make up the wall of the urinary bladder. And of course, if the detrusor muscles contract, that's going to squeeze the urinary bladder and therefore empty it. That doesn't work very well unless the sphincter opens up, because the internal sphincter is keeping that urine in there. It's the only outlet, really. So that the same reflex is causing the internal sphincter to relax. Now, this is what happens automatically in a baby without thinking about it. The external sphincter is about you consciously keeping it in there, even if the reflex is trying to tell you it's micturition time. And that's what hasn't developed in the brain yet in a baby. So it's not able to hold it in even if it wanted to. But up to a point, keeping the external sphincter closed consciously by afferent information that's coming down from the brain, you actually trying to hold it in, that will hold it in even if the internal sphincter has relaxed and you're starting to fill the urethra. That's of course only up to a point, eventually that will be overridden. But this is what allows it. This is what allows the urinary bladder to be emptied according to our demands, rather than just when it gets full or when it's full enough to be emptied. And we are done.